Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is James Nestor, author of Breath, which will be released next week by Riverhead. James is also the author of Deep, Free Diving, Renegade Science, and What the Ocean Tells Us About Ourselves. Kind of almost like a precursor of this book in a way. James has written for Outside, Scientific American, The Atlantic, New York Times, lots of other publications. He's appeared on Nightline, NPR. Breath is about something that we do from the moment we are born, perhaps with the help of a slap on our butts, until the moment we die, save for some medical situations. And we're not aware of this survival technique almost all of our lives, but we are dependent on this process for the human race's very existence. So, but what if we were doing it the wrong way? And by doing it the wrong way, we've distorted our bodies, ruined everything from our posture and our teeth, increased our risk about everything from asthma to sinusitis to periodontal disease, even such seemingly far-fetched troubles as cancer and even depression. So be aware, you may approach this book as I did, with trepidation and an almost certain belief that this is kind of a crazy concept. And even James says that at the beginning of the book. So how can all of this be true? However, after you finish the compelling narrative, you may truly become a believer, not only in the importance of breathing, but the importance of breathing right. So with that, welcome, James, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So first, yeah, your first book, you kind of were... It's like Abbey Road and Let It Be. You were kind of writing this in reverse, weren't you? You started the this book before you started the second.
Yeah, that's basically what happened. I had been experimenting with different breathing techniques for a while, had some very strange physiological effects from them. One in particular, very vigorous pranayama. I sweated through my socks and my t-shirt and my hair and all that, but I didn't know what to do with that story. It was a personal experience, and I write more about science and more about an objective experience that can apply to other people. So I just kind of put that in the back file. And until I met these freedivers who were able to hold their breath and to dive down 300, 400 feet for minutes at a time, they told me the only way that they were able to do what they do, to dive to such incredible depths, was to harness the power of breathing. And if we harness that, we can not only dive, but we also had various benefits on land as well, from healing our bodies to accessing different levels of performance to increasing our longevity.
One of the interesting things about your book, and you're very candid about it, is some of the medical problems you had before you embarked on this. Why don't you enumerate those, because it's a good preface into what you did later.
Sure. I had had pneumonia year after year. I surf a lot, so that might have had something to do with it. The surfing is good here in San Francisco in the winter, so I was constantly wet and cold. I had a lot of bronchitis, had some wheezing. I was snoring on occasion, and I thought that this was just a normal part of being an adult, right? Everyone I knew had these problems. They had asthma, they had allergies, on and on and on, until I realized that, you know, this really wasn't normal. And there's a good chance that our ancestors weren't suffering from all of these respiratory problems that we have now. So I took a deep dive into what happened, why we're breathing so poorly now, why so many of us have these respiratory issues. We carry them with us from childhood into adulthood. And I found another story, which I thought was so much stranger than anything I had intended on researching, this disevolution of the human face and the human mouth.
Well, so, since I got this guy back here.
I'm looking at him. Yeah, he's...
I watched your YouTube video where you kind of like, what's the word? You morph a skull from the way it was to the way it is now. And it is kind of unbelievable, because natural selection generally selects for survival and thriving. So what was the corollary benefit, if there was any? And then talk about what happened to the skull.
There is no benefit to losing the ability to breathe properly. And this is something that I didn't know about before I started this book. Even when after I had written the proposal and was on my way of writing a book about breathing, this story came out of the blue and it utterly fascinated me. What evolution is and what it does is it means change. Evolution means change, and animals can change for the better or for worse. Natural selection is only a very small part of it. So we've adapted a bunch of different capabilities and problems in our bodies that are a detriment to our health. They have nothing to do with making us better. There's nothing good about a third of the U.S. population being obese. Okay? There's nothing good about snoring or sleep apnea or asthma. So this is a concept called disevolution, which was popularized by Daniel Lieberman at Harvard. And it's used to explain why so many of us have a sore back, why our bones are growing thinner, and to a large extent, why we're breathing so poorly now. So that's the nutshell. It's a bit to swallow. And it took me about a year of research into this to truly realize a lot of what I had learned in high school is wrong. It's not about survival of the fittest. That's not really how evolution works. There are other tangents to evolution that are changing us as a species in many ways for the worse.
Well, if that's the case, I can certainly understand how the Industrial Revolution, the changes in food, the crooked teeth part of it, but you also go back hundreds of thousands of years too. So why, I mean, even like if you look at the Neanderthals and the protruding skull and all that kind of stuff, why did that happen? Because that was nature. It wasn't kind of a nurture thing.
Absolutely. And it happened over tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, these changes occurred. But what's happened to the human mouth on a large scale, the reason why we have crooked teeth, the reason why we're breathing so poorly, this all happened mainly in the last 300, 400 years since the advent of industrialized food. And this is a known thing. If you take a skull, a modern skull, and compare it to a skull 1,000 years old, or 10,000 years old, or 100,000 years old, or 1,000,000 years old, those older skulls, by and large, will have perfectly straight teeth, whereas the modern skull, 90% of us, have crooked teeth. So we can tell the age of a skull, modern skull versus an ancient skull, just by looking at its teeth. And this was something I did not believe until I talked to biological anthropologists who have been studying it for decades and decades. I saw the skulls myself. I saw CAT scans of my own face, my own too small mouth, my own crooked teeth, and it suddenly became very apparent.
You know, it's funny because people always talk about mouth breathers, things like that, but apparently most of us are kind of mouth breathers, even though we don't know it.
Well, there's some estimates. The numbers are murky, but anywhere from around maybe 25% to 50% of us breathe through our mouths. And a large percentage of that population is habitually breathing through their mouth. They've lost the ability, functional ability, to breathe through their nose. And if you start breathing through your mouth at a young age, your face is going to start molding to that, right? The bones are going to be developing in that certain way. It's so common, it's called adenoid face. Because when kids get swollen adenoids, they have to breathe through their mouth. So they open their mouth like this, and their face starts growing long. So there's been a ton of research on this, showing the correlation between the pathway in which we breathe and facial growth. And your facial growth is going to determine a large amount of how you're able to breathe, right? So if you're opening your mouth like this all the time, your jaw is drooping back, that's going to block your airways more often than if you're a habitual nose breather, constantly keeping your mouth shut.
When you talk about the numbers, like you talk about, you know, I'm going to breathe 600 million times in my lifetime and 25 sextillion molecules, you know, more than grains of sand on the beach, I think, come in each breath. Okay, there's the numbers. And you've talked about the adenoids. You talk about the shape of the head. But then how do you, and this is where people would start saying, oh, this is some kind of new age. How does that give you cancer? How does that give you depression?
I would never say breathing alone is going to give you cancer or depression. I would say that the way in which you breathe can contribute to these problems and can exacerbate them. So if you're looking at, if you have a blocked airway due to some skeletature problem, because your jaw hasn't grown right, because your nose is always stuffed, because you're breathing through your mouth, when we're taking in untreated, unconditioned, unhumidified air through our mouth, we're exposing our lungs to all of that. And after a while, that can cause respiratory problems. And we know that. And if you're constantly putting your body in this state of stress, other problems can arise from there. If you look at cancer specifically, and this is something I won't get too deep into, cancer is going to start growing and continue growing in areas in which there is the least amount of oxygen in an acidic environment. So how you breathe will affect your circulation, and it will affect how blood will get to throughout your organs and other parts of your body. So there are some correlations between that, but no, I'm not going to go and say how you breathe is going to give you cancer or heal you of cancer, but it will definitely contribute to a laundry list of problems.
Well, another thing that's kind of paradoxical and out there, if you want to put it that way, is this idea about carbon dioxide. I mean, I've been trained to think carbon dioxide is an evil. It can kill you. Trees take it in and breathe out precious oxygen. It's the cause of global warming. But your book takes a completely different tack. Talk a little bit about that and the experiment, too.
Sure. So when I first wrote the proposal for this book, I thought I had it pretty well figured out. And that's how nonfiction works. You write a proposal, and then you're given a modicum of money to go out and research the subject and write about it. So I spent a few months on the proposal, found leaders in the field, thought I had a pretty good idea of how the book was going to lead. And then through every single avenue I went, once I started digging deeper and deeper, many levels, everything was flipped on its head. And CO2 is one of those things. So we need a balance of CO2 and oxygen in our bodies. It's not about constantly getting oxygen in, because we need that carbon dioxide to offload the oxygen into our muscles, into our tissues, into our organs. And this is something almost nobody is talking about. So the way to balance that, the best way of doing that, is to take in less air than you're used to, is to breathe slower. It's not to open your mouth when you're at the gym or walking or even sitting on a couch and huffing, thinking you're getting more oxygen. The more you do that, the more you're denying areas of your body oxygen. And this is such a paradoxical thing to get someone's head around. It took me months and months of talking to leaders in the field, professors, researchers, to really understand this.
You're saying, you know, months talking about it. How have you incorporated it, if you have, into your own lifestyle? Because that seemed hardest to me.
Well, I had to see it for myself, right? And that's something I'm always interested in doing. You can read papers, you can talk to experts, but once you actually see the effects of these things in your own body, you become more convinced. So anyone can get a pulse oximeter, they're $20, and put it on your finger and breathe in different ways. And you'll notice that you can breathe very slowly, and often that O2 is either going to stay at the same level or it's going to increase by breathing slower, by taking in less oxygen. And this is such a contrarian concept that people have a hard time understanding it. The fact is, we breathe out about 3/4 of the air that we breathe in. So if you're breathing faster, you're just offloading all that air. You're not doing anything. By breathing slower, you're able to balance those gases and get more from each breath with less effort. And I think that that's really the key. You don't want to overwork your heart, have a high heart rate, and to breathe more and more. You want to be more economical and breathe less and use that air as much as you can.
Yeah, and you talk about those techniques, and in your first book too, actually, you know, this idea, whether I'm swimming my laps in the pool or whether you're a free diver, there comes a point, at least initially, where you have this, and you talk about this panic response that you have to breathe. And how it, suppose someone is trying to master those techniques, that's the first thing that would become an obstacle for me. It's the fear, it's the panic, and being able to go past that.
Well, I think because a lot of us are programmed to breathe too much, especially people with mental conditions, people with anxiety or depression, consistently breathe too much. And so they consistently have lower levels of carbon dioxide because they're scared of holding their breath. So a very effective therapy, and this is being researched by numerous scientists right now, is to teach these people to breathe slowly and to teach them to hold their breath a little longer and a little longer to get more CO2 into their bodies, which will allow them to offload more oxygen to where it's needed. So, you know, a lot of people are going to feel paranoid by breathing too slow. They're going to think, oh, there's no way I'm getting enough oxygen right now, especially exercising. But I did all kinds of experiments. I worked with the chief of rhinology research at Stanford, and I would get on a stationary bike, and instead of breathing 40 times a minute, as is common, I'd breathe about 6 to 8 times a minute. I was hooked up to a pulse ox, and I was amazed to see, even though I felt very stifled by this, my oxygen levels never wavered. So breathing slower will decrease your heart rate, allow you to go longer, further, stronger, recover better, all those things by just switching your breathing. This is something coaches have known for decades and decades. One method of training that they used to use all the time was they would fill up sprinters' mouths with water or with marbles, and they'd have them run around the track and spit that water back into a cup to teach them how to breathe through your nose. The more you breathe through your nose, the better oxygenation you're going to get, the further you're going to be able to go. And this is really an essential part of breathing that has pretty much been lost. No one's really talking about it. Go to any gym, I mean, if gyms were open right now, and you'd see this. People just, that's not the way to get to where you want to go.
It's really different. You know, it really is different. And then the other thing is that when you're talking about Dr. Nayak, I guess, at Stanford, and then Mariana Evans and Olson, kind of your Kramer-esque character. But then, okay, those are the straightforward people. And that, but then you go off into the Tibetan stuff and the Buddhist stuff, and they seem to mesh in a certain way. It reminds me of how the Dalai Lama meets with the quantum physicists every year, and more the two things come together, and they realize how much there is similar than dissimilar. And that struck me as being very interesting.
And the Dalai Lama has said, he's like, if at any time my beliefs are disproven by science, I'll change my beliefs. That's a lot of confidence, right, in your religion. But they're just finding so many similarities in the ways that they're thinking and approaching their view of the world and their view of science together. And I see the same thing happening with breathing. And it was a little frustrating to see these cycles just repeat over and over and over, over thousands of years. So the ancient Indians knew all about breathing, pranayama. Ancient Chinese knew all about it. They wrote 7 books of the Tao, all based on breathing, what happens when you do it improperly, and what happens when you do it properly. And this just continued. The Buddhists got into it. And they all these disparate cultures seem to find out the same thing at different times without having any contact with one another. They seem to find this code to healthy breathing. And you can trace this, which is what I spend months and months doing, throughout human history. And even up to today, 100 years ago, there was much more breathing awareness than arguably there even is now. And so I found scientists saying, never breathe through your mouth because you're going to get cavities. It's going to make a very acidic environment. It's going to make you more apt to get pneumonia and tuberculosis. And we're finding that so many of these things 100 years ago that were written about are now being shown to be true. If you look at how we're treating patients with COVID, a few weeks ago, we used to put them on their backs and intubate them. Now they're finding, no, put them on their sides or have them sit up. Because when we're laying down on our back, most of the air that we take into our lungs is filling up in our back, not in our chest. So if you're laying down on your back and trying to breathe, you're not getting that gas exchange the same as you would on your side. Well, doctors were talking about this 70 years ago. You know, these are the methods they were using. And so it got a little maddening. I called it like a Groundhog Day, where same people saying the same thing. All these methods worked. They disappeared, rediscovered, different culture, different time, disappeared. And hopefully now we're at a new age of breathing awareness. At least that's what I'm seeing with everything that's happening with COVID.
Yeah, what struck what struck me in one of your YouTube videos was you're comparing a person breathing, and then you showed a person in a hospital bed laying on his back with a ventilator in there. Was it a ventilator or a cannula?
Yeah, ventilator.
Yeah, and that really struck me, because if those two things are the same, then something is drastically wrong.
Of course. And even, if you look at, I was talking to NIAC, many meetings with him. He's a Stanford rhinologist. There are 27 departments in the National Institutes of Health. None of them are studying breathing. None of them are studying the nose. They're studying pathologies associated with breathing. They're studying lung cancers and pneumonia, but they're not looking at the benefits of healthy breathing, nasal breathing, prevention, any of that. And which is pretty shocking, considering this is an act we do 25,000 times a day. We take in more air into our lungs and out of our lungs every day than more in weight than we do in food and drink. So 30 pounds of air enters our lungs and exits our lungs every day. If you think that air doesn't affect how you think, how you act, your physical performance, then I don't think you've looked into the subject as enough as you should, because it certainly does. And I've found it, I've been pretty amazed by so many people in the medical communities still continue to say how we breathe doesn't matter. It's just that we're breathing that's important. And I've found that is pretty false.
Yeah, and the other thing that's interesting is that you could have almost called this book The Nose, because so much of it is about, it reminded me of Nikolai Gogol's short story, The Nose, mm-hmm. where he shaves off his nose and then he finds the nose becoming a bureaucrat and getting out of it. Reminded me, okay, it's just as important as the rest of us, if not more so. And, you talk about that when you're talking about the opening there. And no one thinks about that. I mean, really, no one thinks about that.
And the nose is really just one, it's extremely powerful organ. We need to acknowledge it, but it's really one of only many different parts that you need to understand. You can still breathe through your nose and be unhealthy, right? If you're breathing too much. So there are many components to this. And what I found most interesting about this subject was not the how of breathing, because there's dozens and dozens of books that date thousands of years old, right, on how to breathe properly. It's the what and the who and how specifically it affects our bodies. Why would we want to breathe in certain ways? And why don't we know all this information about proper breathing? What's happened? And the backstory of the characters, these people who for the past 100 years have been talking about this stuff and proving all these therapies were extremely effective and then just kind of disappeared. So it's that whole tangle of stories that I really got immersed in.
Well, it seems like after reading it, I thought, oh, there must be a consensus now amongst all these people. But you're telling me there's not. I mean, the departments don't even begin to study the specific areas you discussed in the book. So how is all this going to make a difference?
Sure. But that's not my role as a journalist who writes about science. And that's something that I found was pretty lacking in this literature, is someone who has an objective standpoint, who goes into this world, learns as much as I could about it, and digest it for a general reader. I found a lot of breathing books, they're either from one position or the other, that you can only breathe very slowly. This is the only way you're going to be helped. Or Wim Hof's philosophy, he's a breathing guru, very, very popular right now, says you got to breathe really hard, once a day. And I don't think that's the right way of looking at this. As one freediver told me, there are as many ways to breathe as there are foods to eat. And you eat different foods to do different things, and you can breathe in certain ways to do certain things as well. I did not set out to change anyone's minds. If I found that mouth breathing was much healthier and the ancients were wrong, I would have had, maybe a much more interesting hook to the book. So I have no skin in any game. I just wanted to provide objective information, which is why there's 600 studies, on my website in the back of the book. And if you don't agree with my observations, then you can look up those studies and read them for yourself and make up your own mind about that.
It's interesting because you talk about Mount Kilimanjaro, which I climbed like 15 years ago. And you say there's a 50% success rate, but sometimes they'll take you on a longer route. So you climb high, sleep low. And towards the end, you definitely could feel the difference, but it wasn't. Well, first of all, I had Diamox, and there happened to be a neurosurgeon in our group, and he brought Decadron. And so if I did have any pulmonary edema, and cerebral edema, that definitely helped. But it's true that, and I'm rambling now, but it's kind of like meditation. You know, Shambhala meditation is basically you're breathing. That's the whole thing. The thoughts come in, the feelings come in, and then they go out. And, you know, people say, well, I need to meditate more. What happens when you meditate? And I had a bumper sticker that says nothing happens. And that's kind of like, it's not something that's going to dramatically change the way you present yourself to other people and things like that. But there's no reason why it couldn't lead to enlightenment of a sort. And it kind of seems like it did with you in a way.
Well, I believe, after talking to so many researchers about this stuff, that the main benefit of meditation, especially at the beginning, is it forces you to calm down and focus on your breath. Almost every meditation starts with focus on your breath and slow down. You're not going to go and meditate and be extremely stressed out. So this causes a physiological change in your body, in the way you're thinking about things, in your circulation, how your organs are communicating with one another, hormone levels, on and on and on. And I think once you get that down, you can go on to the further levels of really focusing on your consciousness and getting many other benefits from that. But at the beginning, I'm convinced that meditation is breathing and breathing is meditation. And you can start there while thinking about whatever you want to think about. If you're breathing the same way you would be meditating, you are going to change your body. And we know that.
I mean, there's a couple of things about meditation. One is don't be judgmental about the fact that you're not doing it enough. And the second thing is just the idea of the combination of breathing in and breathing in all of the bad stuff and then breathing it out. But don't expect that you're not going to breathe in the bad stuff again. And so now I realize, okay, what you were saying about depression, it definitely does make sense, you know.
Well, it helps focus your mind off of other things. And Patricia Garbarg and Richard Brown, psychiatrists in New York, quite famous authors, they use this breathing technique that is so deceptively simple, no one would think it would possibly work, but it's been studied extensively, shows that you increase oxygen to your brain, shows that your sympathetic nervous system is shut off, you're able to relax, and all it takes is breathing in for 6 seconds, and breathing out for 6 seconds, and breathing in for 6 seconds, and out. And doing that for even a few minutes a day can have measured change. They've shown measured change with people with anxiety, depression, and other disorders. They even used it for 9/11 survivors who had this ghastly condition called ground glass lungs. So nothing else worked for these people, but breathing this way, to inhale fully and to exhale fully, was able to purge a lot of toxins from their lungs and work better than any other treatment. So I would say to people, like, seems so simple, breathe through your nose. Seems so simple, breathe slowly, or practice some very slow breathings for a few minutes a day. But I think you would be amazed by what this does to you. And again, I wasn't looking so much at what it did to my own body, but how this affects everyone who practices these simple techniques. You don't need spirituality. You don't need religion to do this. This is how your body wants to take in oxygen and how it wants to expel it. So it's very natural. You're placing your body in its natural state, and that's what breathing properly is all about.
There were two examples you gave. Let's see if I can remember them. The first one, unless I'm remembering it wrong, is men generally who are in war but weren't injured. Talk about that one. And then I'll go to the second one.
Okay. Then I don't need to write these down. I'll just sort of remember that. So what happens when we are extremely stressed out is we can get sympathetic nervous system overload. Sympathetic nervous system is the fight or flight action that occurs in our bodies that shunts a bunch of blood from our extremities into our essential organs, makes us more aware of our environments. We get a cortisol drip, all of those things, gets us ready to fight or flight. So they found that these soldiers who had been right about to enter battle, but never entered battle, were just sitting there stressed out so much they essentially blew a fuse. So they could not turn that off. They were constantly in this stress state, breathing this way. Their heart rates were crazy, beating twice as much as they should be. And the only way to really fix them was to teach them to relax. By teaching them to relax, they were able to switch off that sympathetic nervous system and switch on that relaxed nervous system function and get back to normal. So what they found is breathing this way on occasion, if you're doing it consciously, is actually good for our bodies. If you think about most of us today, we spend our nights half awake and our days half asleep, constantly in this gray zone of stress. So that's not good because we're never relaxing and we're never stimulated. So many breathing techniques, including many pranayamas, Tummo, Wim Hof method, forces you into the sympathetic state for 20 minutes so that the other 23 and a half hours of the day, you're going to be able to be calm and relaxed. And it's incredibly therapeutic. There are so many studies backing that up, especially for people with autoimmune diseases whose immune systems go rogue in their own bodies, cause a rash of problems. These people were able to regain control of their autonomic nervous system and their immune systems and to either blunt or sometimes just stop these conditions just by breathing.
It's funny you mentioned earlier, you know, the situation we're in with Corona, COVID. And I wonder now that all these people are working from home, which is where I am now, where you are now, you know, now I go out, I have a nice property that has plenty of places to walk. So now I go out and walk. I relax as I'm walking. I actually have found that my breathing is different. And I wonder, one, is it going to be beneficial, at least to the first world people? You know, these are first world problems for us. If it's going to be beneficial. And then when they go back, are they not going to want to be there? Are they going to say, you know, I'd rather be back the old way? Is it going to be a stressor to go back into the working environment where you have your cubicle and you're sitting down?
Well, you know, these may be first world problems, but the benefit of breathing is open to everybody. It doesn't require Wi-Fi or a mobile phone or anything. It requires just focused attention on how air is coming into our bodies and how we're exhaling it. So anyone can get these benefits. You can learn how to breathe properly for free online, you know, and again, it's the how was very, very obvious to me. It's the why and what this does to us, which I found so powerful. So I think anxiety levels are through the roof as they have been for the past 2 months. And I think people are probably breathing pretty poorly now. So now more than ever, I think it could benefit you by just adopting a few different habits. I don't want to proselytize. I'm not here to preach, but I've learned a few things. I've had my own experiences in labs. I've seen the data, and I'm convinced making just a few small tweaks to your daily habits can have a transform you in a lot of ways. Maybe not for everyone, but it certainly has for me and for most of the people I've talked to.
It's funny because I have an independent bookstore, and your book will be on the front table, but it won't do you any good because no one can come in.
Take a picture, you know.
You know, it's in the window, and we are doing curbside now and direct shipping. But so many people come in, and they'll tell me, I just don't have time to read. I go, well, you do have time. We all have the same amount of time. You know, you just, if you're watching, you know, the Kardashians, no, you don't have time to read this book. But I can just see talking to someone about this and them going, I don't have time to breathe. I don't have time to, and basically that's what they're saying.
Anyone has time to breathe. We're breathing all the time. And that's another benefit of this practice that I've found. If you talk about someone getting a bunch of benefits from eating vegan or eating keto or paleo, that's a commitment. It's hours a day. You're thinking about it all the time. Same thing with exercise. Hey, you should go out and exercise 2 hours a day. Do your world a good. But we're breathing all the time. So right now, as I'm talking to you, I can change my breathing and affect my body in different ways. When I'm driving a car, walking my dog, sitting on a couch and watching the Kardashians, you know, you can entertain yourself with that if you choose, but you can change your breathing and also get a benefit from that. And that's where I found this to be a really powerful tool and universal. You know, it's an egalitarian tool that that anyone can use. And no one's really thinking about it. From even in the medical community, very few people are looking at the benefits of breathing. They're looking at the problems associated with lungs that stop us from breathing, but not looking at the benefits. And I feel that that is starting to change in a big way right now with all the news of COVID and respiratory health.
I find I've been doing it during this interview. And actually, I don't want to become a disciple necessarily, but I wouldn't have been able to remember the second thing I wanted to tell you about, I don't think, if I wasn't doing this. And the second thing I wanted to ask you about was the athletes in Mexico City. Yeah. And what they did, and well, first of all, you know, they're training at height. If they have the chance to train at height, and they're running at height without oxygen. And that was very interesting because I didn't think that was what they did.
So this is one of those stories of a researcher who came about, discovered something, and was quickly dismissed or disappeared after he died. So this hack came from a choral teacher, taught students how to sing in New Jersey. And he noticed that a lot of them were losing volume and losing resonance and tone in their voices because they weren't breathing properly. So he thought, what if I enabled them to breathe a little deeper so that they could exhale more? Because everything's on the exhale. How we talk, how we're singing, everything we vocalize is on the exhale. So he was able to develop their diaphragms to enable them to go a little deeper and go a little higher, and start winning choral competitions, teaching members of the Met Opera how to sing better, on and on. He got so famous that the emphysema ward at the VA hospitals on the East Coast said, we've got some other people here who could use some help breathing. They're emphysemics, and they've been sitting here for years, and we don't know what to do with them. So long story short, these people had lost the ability to breathe properly. So they would sit in bed and breathe dozens and dozens of breaths a minute. So by simply allowing them to loosen their diaphragms, allowing them to take a deep breath, most importantly, to take a deep breath out, he healed these people. Well, I won't say heal, that's a contentious term. He was able to get them up to a level of health in which they were able to leave the hospital. And this therapy was more effective than anything else anyone was using. It's backed up by x-rays, it's backed up by data. So he then went on, after 10 years in hospitals, he was asked by the Olympic Committee to start training runners for Mexico City Olympics. Mexico City's at what, 7,000 feet? So he went to Tahoe and trained them to engage their diaphragms, just shifting their. And they started breaking personal bests, edging towards world records. They went down to the Olympics, and it was the greatest, you know, victory of yeah. any track team. And I think still to this day in history. And what was even more amazing, these runners did not take oxygen before or after their races. They just breathed slowly. So it just, that to me just so patently, this was after a few weeks of training, so patently showed the effects of proper breathing. And no one's discounted what he's done. The data holds today, but when this guy died, it was immediately forgotten. Emphysemics, if you go on the National Institutes of Health right now, there's no mention of diaphragmatic breathing, of breathing deeper and developing the diaphragm to get over their condition. And very few runners or trainers are aware of their breathing, this deep breathing as well. So that's another, you know, new science of the lost art there. And these stories just kept repeating over and over.
It's really weird.
It's very weird, but the, you know, all the science is there. And even pulmonologists at these VA hospitals were stunned by what he was able to do. Absolutely stunned. And then when he left, it all went away. So hopefully we will have a deeper realization and appreciation for this simple act going forward.
You know, when you said there's lots of different ways to come at this. Tell the other technique, which I did try, about the Navy SEALs, about breathing in, holding, and breathing out, holding. That's an interesting one.
Yes, it's, again, very basic, and this balances your nervous system, right? So all it is breathe into a count of 4, 2, 3, 4, hold, 2, 3, 4, exhale, 2, 3, four, hold, two, three, four. It's called box breathing. So you inhale the same amount that you hold, which is the same amount as you exhale. And this, if you do this before you're stressed out, this will focus your mind and help you become more grounded. At least that's what people say. I've used this quite often, and I like it for that same reason. If you want to go to sleep, you extend the exhales, because exhaling is a parasympathetic activity. It lulls your body into relaxation. So you can extend your exhales to 6 or 8. And that's a pretty powerful tool to relax yourself.
Oh, yeah. Talk about respirations per minute back when, what we do now, and then talk about what yogis are able to do.
Mm-hmm. So the data is murky here, but from what I was able to scope out, it did look like people were breathing less. Right? It was considered normal to breathe from 8 to 12 breaths per minute just 30 years ago on back. And this is what data has shown us. Today, what's considered normal is 12 to 20. So that's the normal range. So breathing less than 12 breaths per minute right now is considered abnormal. But from what I've found, breathing less than 12 breaths is very beneficial to the body. And there's, again, a lot of research and a lot of people studying this. So the ancient Chinese breathed 13,000 breaths a day. They actually had the time to count this stuff. I don't know how they did that. One guy watching the other guy as he watched the, but they said that was the optimum amount to breathe, which works out to about 9, 10 breaths per minute. So we do know that by breathing slowly and by breathing deeper, you are lessening the burden on your heart. You're able to circulate your blood more easily. You're able to oxygenate everything more easily. So there was certainly some wisdom to what they were doing way back then. And we can see that in studies today.
Yeah, well, there's kind of a contradiction there, because what you just said was, and trying to do it, you can slow your breathing, but you're saying breathe deep. But part of your book is about not breathing deep.
Okay. So you want to engage your diaphragm. You do not want to, breathing 6 times a minute does not mean and saying, I'm breathing 6 times a minute, I'm feeling getting oxygen in there. You want about a half a liter in there. And because you're going to get more gas exchange deeper in your lungs. We know that because blood is gravity dependent, and there's more blood at the bottom of your lungs than there is at the top. So breathing that way is going to be a lot more efficient for you. When you breathe through your nose, you're going to be breathing deeper. That's just how it works out. So breathing less, that's very effective for people who have chronic anxieties or people who have asthma. They've shown that breathing, because these people breathe way too much. So the point of breathing less isn't to cause people to breathe way less than is normal. It's to get them back into that normal range. So if someone's breathing 25, 30 times a minute, you want to train them back to the normal range. So you show them the power and the simplicity of breathing slower so that they will feel more comfortable breathing at a normal range. So that's the key to breathing, is to breathe per your metabolic needs. You don't want to breathe too little that you're not getting enough oxygen. That's bad news. You don't want to breathe too much that you're overworking your body. It's to breathe just enough so that you're not overburdening any system in your body.
It's funny. It's easier said than done, because the people that have the most anxiety are going to have the most anxiety about attempting to do this. You really have to somehow push them.
Well, that's not my job to push them. My job is to provide the background of why this would work and to interview researchers in the field who are pursuing this research right now. If you look at someone like Justin Feinstein, neuropsychologist at Laureate Institute of Brain Research, so he's found it's really hard to get people with chronic anxieties to hold their breath. They last right. about 5 seconds. So he is giving them carbon dioxide. So to help reset them, because he knows that they're not going to do this on their own, but he is administering heavy doses of carbon dioxide to get them used to that feeling, to bring them back down to normal again.
So well, you did it too, right?
I did. I did.
And you also had problems with, not initial problems with it.
It was not fun at all. I'm not saying that this is a pleasant thing that people should go out and do. Don't do it unless you need to, and unless you're under the supervision of a professional working in a lab. So he got an NIH grant to research this stuff. So he's a real pro. He's got it very professionally set up. And yeah, I did it because this is another, carbon dioxide therapy has been around for 100 years. Studied at Yale, studied at Harvard, studied at all the top institutions. And again, it's another one of these things that came up, never disproven, and went away. And it's fascinating now to see scientists and researchers rediscovering this stuff and saying, wait, this is really effective. And now we have the machines to measure how effective it is. And so to be in that world, and it's just that that stuff is just sort of starting up right now. And it was a thrill to be right in the inside of this and watching this sort of bubbling up one more time.
Another way you went off on a tangent of sorts is how you talked about, you know, the guys that are, I've forgotten the technique, you know, generate heat and would, you know, you go into ice baths and, or you swim in the Arctic Circle. And I've read about some of these people, but how is that even effective? I mean, how does your breath actually get you to that point? Mm. It's magical.
So this is a breathing practice that's been around for more than 1,000 years. And throughout various centuries, people called BS on it, right? So these monks would go out in the middle of the night and they'd sit there with just a thin cloth sheet on, and sit in the snow and breathe in certain ways to melt a circle around themselves for hours and hours. They were able to do this night after night. So nobody really understood it or believed it. So all of these travelers would go to India, they go to Tibet, they go into certain areas of China and see these monks do this, but we didn't have video cameras, we didn't have recorders. A bunch of people thought it was just some myth. Until in 1980, Herbert Benson, who was a Harvard researcher, went to India, got these monks, hooked them up with sensors, and had them do this TUMO, the superheating, inner heat breathing. And he found that they were able to increase the temperature in their fingers by 17 degrees. And they were able to dry wet sheets placed on their backs in a very cold room within about a half an hour, just by breathing in certain ways. So this breathing technique was then adopted by a Dutch man named Wim Hof. Now hundreds of thousands of people are doing this. And what they found is it not only helps to superheat the body, but it can also help heal a bunch of chronic diseases. And I know that sounds like pseudoscience and hogwash, but there are studies at very legitimate institutions and scientists looking into this now and finding is very effective, especially for autoimmune diseases. What I think is so interesting about this technique is we know about 50% of how it works. We can see what hormones are secreted into the bloodstream. We can see how breathing in certain ways will stimulate a sympathetic response, create more heat, but we don't know how it's able to protect these people against frostbite and hypothermia. We don't know how they're able to sit in the snow or in a bucket of ice for hours and hours and not come down with these with any problems. So that's what I think is very fascinating about the science of breathing is we think we've gotten everything figured out, but there's still so much more to learn about our own body's potential and how we can use this very simple tool to do a bunch of things that just a few years ago were considered medically impossible.
So you say, since you said it, I can say it. So you kind of said, yeah, you thought this was hogwash, but it sounds like none of this is apocryphal. None of this is anecdotal.
Not at all. You can see the studies on I put the whole bibliography of the book on my site. You can go there and see it, or it's in the back of the book.
Yeah.
If you happen to buy it. So it's all available, and you can look up TUMO, Wim Hof breathing, and you can see videotapes of these monks filmed by Harvard watching them do their thing. And if that's not legit enough, and the study that he released came out in Nature, one of the most esteemed scientific journals around. So this is not some guy in Arizona in his garage making claims on the internet. This is legitimate stuff. And it's still so hard. When I've talked to the doctors in my extended family here, they say, no, no, that's impossible. No, can't happen. And then I send them the studies and they just kind of say, that's interesting. And that's it. So people are pretty confounded. And I think that we're just learning the human body's true potential and its capabilities right now. And breathing is definitely a component, an anchor to allow us to do all these things that, again, were considered impossible decades ago, but are showing are a part of our makeup right now and that almost everyone's able to tap into.
You know, it's funny. In closing out, it's like, and it's a tough question to ask because, you know, given the current situation, as we've discussed, other threats, global warming, asteroids, war, our country's future as a democracy. And I know you're going to just say you're a reporter and everyone from Outside Magazine does exactly the same thing. But if we go back to our skull, our lungs, oxygen, CO2, and the future, I'm not saying, okay, this is a panacea. I'm not saying your book is a panacea. I understand that. You're reporting what you learned. But if something was going to happen that was going to make us better in terms of health and as a species, as a hypothetical, what would you believe that could be?
Well, I think it's already happening, and it's happening because of awareness. We didn't know about these things 10 years, 20 years ago, right? I mean, think about what's happened with food. I think about the stuff I ate as a kid, how awful that is. And think about our awareness now. Now we know how bad that stuff is. And we know the sources that were telling us this stuff is good are BS. So I think through awareness, you're allowing to give people a choice. So not everyone's going to dedicate their life to breathing, right? Maybe some people don't even want to do it for 10 minutes properly, 10 minutes or 20 minutes a day. But to have that choice for the people who do decide they want to do this and improve their health, that's what I think it's all about. And from what I've heard from doctors and researchers, one of them told me this. He said, how we breathe is as important to our health, happiness, and longevity as what we eat or how much we exercise, whatever genes we've inherited. This is really a missing pillar of health. So you can't ever really be healthy, even if you're eating right, even if you're exercising hours a day, if you don't have your breathing in check. And so I really think it needs to be considered along with those two other elements when we're talking about how we feel or what we're able to do. And the awareness of that, I hope, is going to continue. And again, as I said at the beginning, the one benefit or silver lining to this foul, foul COVID flu is that I think it's making people a lot more aware that the ways in which we breathe are so important.
That's an excellent way of ending this. So thank you so much for joining us today, James. It's a pleasure. And as I said, you know, it's always nice for me when I read a book because, you know, and that's the other thing. Everyone comes in my bookstore says you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person who comes in does. So you should be proud of the cover. And, you know, it is of lungs and it does show all this interconnectedness. And it will, you know, and it makes a difference. And that's why publishers figure out covers.
So a lot of debate on that cover, but we finally came to it.
I figured.
There. Okay. Always is.
Yep. Every author I've ever talked to. Yeah. Okay. Thanks so much, James. Pleasure.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah, we'll edit out that one section where there was a disconnect, and then that'll be the radio. And then since I'm new to doing this, then I'll have my engineer edit out the end of the video part and that gap in the middle.
Perfect. That sounds great. Thanks for the great questions, by the way. Usually people don't read the book. They read some bullet points. What is breathing?
And yeah, like, I know. Well, like, you know, man, when you say
you read it, you had names, you had stats.
It's like if you go on CBS Morning News, you're not going to have, you're going to have 5 minutes and it's not going to be someone who read.
And I know that drill. So it was great talking with someone who has an interest in this stuff. I think it allows the conversation to be much more.
Yeah. And you know, the biggest part of life for me is the idea is you're here to gain as much information as you can. And then being a bookseller and reading books constantly, it's not, you know, it was like when I was in college and I was majoring in English literature and I graduated with high honors. The reason I graduated with high honors was because I read the books. You know, all my friends were reading Cliff Notes and Spark Notes. And I said, just read the book, you know, And then you get an A. It's just really easy, whether it's the mayor of Castor Bridge or War and Peace or whatever it is.
And it's the key to life, right? Just read the book. You're going to get an A, not only in school, but in
everything.
The best of practice. Yeah.
Yeah. I slept through all my classes. If I hadn't read books, I wouldn't have been able to talk intelligently to you if that's what this was. Okay. Have a good day.
All right. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate
it. You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.